from the North Carolina Reading Service. To our blind and print-impaired listeners, we present the Indie Week. John Federson reading this issue, which is dated July 6th of 2022. Our theme music today, played by the anonymous duet, known only as Redacted. Beautiful job. Wish I knew who they were. And we will move right into Jasmine Gallup's column from Wake County, Faith Choice. And it's a question and answer with Reverend Katie Zeh, Z-E-H, an ordained Baptist minister. With abortion in North Carolina under imminent threat, Reverend Katie Zeh is encouraging Christians to speak up about their pro-choice beliefs and reminding patients that having an abortion isn't the sin that an extreme minority says it is. Zeh, an ordained Baptist minister in Apex and serves as the CEO of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, RCRC. She published her second book in February, A Complicated Choice, Making Space for Grief and Healing in the Pro-Choice Movement. So these are questions and answers. How did you become a minister? I grew up in a very conservative evangelical in a small town in southeast Georgia, and my faith was very important to me. Then I went to Davidson College, and I started to study theology for the first time. I realized there was a lot about my faith tradition I didn't know much about. It was a humbling experience, having come from a tradition where there's a lot of black and white. I was examining my faith and making some different decisions about how to live into it. I got to the end of college, and I was hungry to do more, so I went to seminary school. How did your attitude toward your faith change as you studied theology? There was an expansiveness to it. Having all the answers was really important to the faith community I was raised in. Knowing this is the truth, this isn't. These are people who are Christian, these are not people who are Christian. There was a lot of division. Then all of a sudden it was like, no, this is a lot bigger. It allowed me to fully embrace my authentic self because I had never really felt comfortable within the confines of what I had been taught it meant to be a faithful white woman. I thought those parts of me that didn't fit were wrong, something I needed to repent from and become something different. I lost community in that search, and it was lonely in that way. But to find myself was priceless. How did you get involved in abortion rights? While I was a student, I did pastoral care training with RCRC about how to accompany someone making a decision about a pregnancy or experiencing a loss. I was really taken by that, so I contacted the abortion clinic across the street from the campus and asked if I could come in and tour. The day I arrived at the clinic, I had to drive through the line of protesters, and they assumed I was a patient there to have an abortion. To be on the receiving end of the harassment was very emotionally impactful. It felt like a moment of call. I remember thinking, oh my gosh, the people who are like me, we share a faith tradition, are outside harassing patients, yelling, trying to keep them from their appointments. That's how they are living into their faith in this moment. It wasn't right. The narrative inside that abortion clinic is a godless place. I just felt there's so much here I can do. There's so many parts of it that pull at my heart. I think especially because of the ways that white Christian nationalists have made this the center of their political agenda and have weaponized Christianity against people seeking abortion care. What kind of work did you do at the clinic? Being inside the clinic and getting to witness how much care and compassion there was really beautiful to me, so I decided to volunteer weekly. One day they needed someone to actually come into the procedure room. I think they were down a staff person and simply needed someone to hold the hands of the patients. I had this really sacred, beautiful experience of being able to accompany people through a very vulnerable moment. It wasn't that I had any specific skills or beautiful words. It was more just my presence helped break what can be a very isolating moment. Why is it important to make space for a conversation about faith with abortion patients? With a decision to have an abortion, some people have a mix of feelings because it's a big decision. And sometimes when we have those uncomfortable feelings, people start wondering, am I feeling this way because I did something wrong? Even if they know they made the right decision and feel relieved about it, there might be a part that's asking, was it wrong? A lot of times it's external messaging that told them what they were doing is wrong. Maybe they were never part of a faith community that told them that. They just absorbed it from the culture or heard it from the protesters as they were walking in, or they've got a relative or a friend who's anti-abortion. Creating a space for people to feel like it's safe to bring up those concerns and questions is important. And rather than giving them a black and white answer, I ask them to sit with their feelings and explain, just because you have a feeling that's uncomfortable does not mean that you did anything wrong. It means you did something really human. It's so important to give people the space to ask questions. Then I try to turn them back to what is true within them. We all know within ourselves what we need. How has the faith community changed over the years in its attitude toward abortion? We see an overrepresentation of a very fringe belief. The white Christian nationalist platform around abortion is the thing we hear about the most, and it's not representative of most people. Until recently, I think people have been very quiet about their support for abortion access. In particular, there's a lot of internalized abortion stigma we all have that functions to keep us quiet. Many religious leaders, many faith communities, even a lot of faith-based organizations that do justice work have been really reticent to pick up and just talk about this issue. Now that we're in this moment, and we've been seeing the things like the anti-abortion law in Texas, people no longer feel like they can be quiet about their support. I see a huge uptick in the number of people reaching out to my organization who want to be involved in this work, who recognize this is a matter of faith to make sure that people get the care they need. The work of reproductive justice advocates and the extreme legislation we're seeing has been a wake-up call for a lot of people of faith to say, wait a second, this is not okay. The U.S. Supreme Court just overturned Roe v. Wade. In the light of that decision, what pro-choice are you doing now, and what are you planning for the future? We've been preparing for this moment for a long time. Those of us who have been in this space have seen this coming, so it's not a surprise for us in that way. There is an immediate need to figure out how to make sure people get care. A lot of folks are going to have to travel a lot farther. It's going to be much more difficult. Lots of folks have not been able to access abortion care easily for a long time, so that's not new. It's just the magnitude and the numbers. I've also been doing a lot of speaking with churches, in particular, on how we got here and how we can move forward. I really emphasize the importance of addressing the internalized abortion stigma. People support legal abortion as a majority, but a lot of people think abortion is morally wrong, and there's this gap in what people think the law should be and their feelings about abortion. Internalized abortion stigma is very similar to how internalized racism and sexism function. That it's our responsibility to identify it and start to challenge it so we can actually show up and help the people who are most impacted. It's really important to show up for people in a compassionate way and not from a place of judgment, and that requires a lot of internal work. Now, at the end of this article was a little sidebar. The Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice also offers online resources, including the Religion and Repro Learning Center, a website to help equip activists, scholars, religious leaders, and others in support of reproductive freedom. It includes webinars, online classes, and discussion groups. The website helps, quote, unpack the narrative around faith and abortion, Ze says. Pastoral care training, virtual and in person, to help people learn how to accompany and provide spiritual support to someone having an abortion. And finally, it provides a pro-choice website with spiritual resources like meditations and journal prompts, as well as accurate medical and legal information about abortions. That from Jasmine Gallup. And now, still from Durham, Tomasi McDonald's column, Housing Needed Yesterday. In the Bull City, gone are the days when members of its working class could purchase modest bungalows for $50,000 to $100,000 and use equity from the home to put a kid through college or start a small business. The housing crisis that took root well before the pandemic is happening while the city is in the midst of a near unprecedented economic boom. The dynamic has created an ironic existential question: who gets to live in Durham? Black people, whose ancestors helped make Durham one of the most unique and culturally acclaimed cities in the country, are leaving. Over the past decade, the U.S. Census shows the city's black population has decreased, owing in part to gentrification and the displacement of low-income residents by more affluent newcomers. In an effort to address African Americans' displacement and growing exodus from Durham, the City Council last month approved two housing development proposals that will build more than 325 affordable housing units in the historic Bragtown community over the next 2 years. Bragtown faces an existential housing crisis that threatens many of its legacy residents' ability to continue to afford living in the neighborhood, according to an analysis from two affordable housing developers of the community's housing crisis. Longtime Bragtown residents last month told council members that the affordable housing plans are monumental and historic and should serve as a blueprint in neighborhoods throughout an increasingly unaffordable city. The first development, known as Fairhaven Walk, calls for the Wisconsin-based Commonwealth Development Corporation of America to construct 192 multifamily affordable housing units along the 300 block of Old Oxford Road. The second project, a joint venture between Triangle-based companies Kelly's Development and Bradley Housing Developers, will build Sandy Ridge Station, a housing complex that will provide 132 affordable units along the 800 and 900 blocks of Old Oxford Road. The affordable housing developments were desperately needed yesterday. Kelly Development and Bradley Housing Developers, which did the affordable housing analysis of the Bragtown community, found that higher housing costs and low, stagnant household incomes, especially for African-American seniors on fixed incomes, have had their predictable end result. And the analysis stated, quote, Bragtown has begun to experience meaningful levels of economic dislocation. Many are simply incapable of funding next month's rent check, while others have fallen victim to predatory home buying and investment activity increasingly prevalent in the neighborhood. Vanessa Mason Evans, president of the Bragtown Community Association, told Indy this week that many of the community's residents earn about $19,000 to $20,000 a year and are being pushed into rural communities after their new white, wealthier neighbors build $300,000 and $400,000 homes next to modest bungalows where the residents have lived for generations. Mason Evans, whose roots in Bragtown date back to the emancipation of formerly enslaved people with the end of the Civil War, says that over the past 2 years, nearly 30 homes in the community that were formerly occupied by friends and neighbors with whom she grew up are become inhabited by someone else or are empty. And she says, so our fight for Bragtown is to let the city and county know that people need help to stay in their places. People are moving to Hillsborough, Burlington, Holly Springs, and even Reedsville. They're moving to certain places where it's cheaper, but even in those places, the prices are going up. They're moving in with family in order to not get put out on the street. And I'm seeing too many elders being pushed out because they can't pay their taxes. The groundbreaking next year for the hundreds of affordable rental units doesn't offer much by way of home ownership and building generational wealth in Bragtown, but it does provide a means of keeping long-time residents in the historically black community. According to executive summaries from Reginald Johnson, director of the city's Community Development Department, the developments will span 8 separate parcels of land that cover about 14 acres. Both developments along Old Oxford Road, quote, will be deemed affordable to residents whose household income is 70% or less of Durham County's area median income. Area median income, AMI. Johnson explained in a summary to City Manager Wanda Page, adding 21% of the units will be affordable to households with incomes at 30% AMI. The City Council's approval of the projects on June 21 required both developers to submit a 4% tax credit bond application to North Carolina Housing Finance Agency during its rolling acceptance period between May the 2nd and September 30th. To fill the remaining funding gaps for those projects, the city made loan commitments totaling more than $8 million to the developers. These funds will come from Forever Home Durham, the city's $160 million program that is at the heart of a $95 million affordable housing bond that voters overwhelmingly passed in 2019. Community development officials point to a finding by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that reports, quote, there are over 12,000 renter households in Durham, most of them very low income, paying more than 50% of their income for housing. The issue is most acute in communities like Bragtown, where developers determined that while Durham's population growth continues to explode, a significant number of new residents are attracted to places like Bragtown instead of, quote, more suburban, homogeneous subdivision communities like Briar Creek. Indeed, the community's diversity, proximity to downtown, and relatively inexpensive housing has attracted a broader home buyer market for effectively the first time in neighborhood history, according to the developers. And they conclude, as house prices increased, most Bragtown residents received a higher rent payment instead of benefiting from an increase in the home's equity. Bragtown residents trace the community's origins to the end of the Civil War when the newly emancipated men and women left the Stagville Plantation, the largest forced labor camp in the state, some 10 miles away, and settled in North Durham. Bragtown residents say it is the oldest African-American community in the state. Constance Wright is a former co-chair of the Bragtown Community Association and a retired lifelong Durham resident who has owned a home in Bragtown for nearly 35 years. She told the city council that her community has been historically overlooked when it comes to investments that will improve the overall quality of life for its residents. Quote, with today's boom economy and financial increases in the cost of living, many residents of Bragtown will not be able to afford to continue living in a community they have considered home for years without gap funding assistance for Fairhaven Walk and Sandy Ridge Station. Larissa Seibel, director of the Healthy Homes and Lead Poisoning Prevention Program with the nonprofit Reinvestment Partners, told council members about the nearly 80 evictions that were set to take place over a two-day period at the downtown courthouse, saying, quote, but we really, really need affordable housing. That's what's going to make a big difference in Durham. We just can't keep putting people out. We've got to have more affordable housing so that families, especially families with children, but everyone, has stable, affordable housing. Bragg-town resident Donna Frederick retired last year after owning and operating the now-closed Playhouse Toy Store on 9th Street for more than a dozen years. She's lived in her dark brick home in the Colonial Village subdivision for nearly 20 years. She told the council that the two projects could be game changers for Bragg-town and the entire city. She said, "These two projects that came before you are very, very important, and we have had multiple meetings with those developers, one-on-one and in groups, so we're all on the same page. This could be a monumental decision with presenting affordable housing to Durham, especially Bragg-town." Mason Evans said she hopes the plan will become a blueprint for black communities across the city as an example of, quote, how communities should be working with developers who are not just making it more expensive, where people have to move out of Durham and move into county areas where there's no hospitals, clinics, or grocery stores. Now, with the trend of refurbishing and flipping of old homes for $300,000 or more, long-time residents worry about losing their homes because of exponential increases in property taxes. 2 years ago, John Killeen, the director of the nonprofit DataWorks, found that in 2010, residents could afford nearly 70% of homes for sale in Bragg-town. In 2018, only 47% of residents were able to afford a home in the community. Colleen noted that the costlier homes have led to higher taxes and the threat of displacement. He said, as of April 2020, Bragg-town was the location of 270 of the 3,200 tax-delinquent properties in Durham County. He also pointed out that Bragg-town residences make up more than 8% of the county's total tax-delinquent properties. The public first learned about the community's affordable housing crisis in 2020 when the Bragg-town Community Association petitioned the city's planning commission to preserve its neighborhoods. Community leaders were up in arms with a developer who wanted to build 900 new homes along Danube Lane with 20 affordable housing units. Mason Evans says, at first they said they would build 10 affordable homes. Then they said 20. 10 was a slap in the face. Members of the city's planning commission twice voted unanimously to knock down developers' rezoning requests to build homes in their neighborhoods. Several months later, Kelly Development in Durham purchased more than 100 acres of land in Bragg-town to begin the Sandy Ridge Station project and Sandy Villa, a 66-unit senior housing complex. Ted Heilbronn, lead developer for the project, told Indy that after spending just a couple of minutes in the community and speaking with the residents, he realized there was a huge need for affordable housing in Bragg-town. Quote, "What we learned is that it's impossible to spend any time there and not get a sense of the community. The legacy residents who have lived there for 50 and 60 years are most at risk." Heilbronn says the project is a joint venture with Kelly Development and Bradley Housing that has ongoing affordable housing projects in Wilmington, Rocky Mount, and Garner. And he explains the goal from the outset of the project was to build market-rate quality housing at prices affordable for Bragg-town residents. The previous developer wanted to build 10 to 20 affordable units that the community association pushed back on. Frankly, that's worse than offering none at all. Heilbronn says the current project started with the premise of building 200 affordable units on two separate locations for the family complex and seniors. Sandy Ridge, whose construction will begin early next year, will feature elevators, a swimming pool, and no 900-square-foot two-bedroom apartments. And they will accept housing choice vouchers. 28 of the 132 units have been earmarked for residents who earn 30% of Durham's AMI, meaning a one-bedroom apartment will rent for $450 a month, a two-bedroom for $550, and a three-bedroom for $650. For residents who earn 40% of the AMI, a one-bedroom will rent for $640, two-bedroom $770, and three-bedroom from $880. And Heilbrunn says the balance of the units will be 60% AMI, with some at 70%. Mason Evans told the city council that the construction of over 325 affordable housing units would be historic. Not just for Bragtown, Mason Evans said, but for Durham. Some other intriguing and potentially positive, well, they are positive, news still from Durham now comes from Lena Geller. Crisis diversion. Three of Durham's new community safety pilot programs are up and running as of last week. A woman is afraid she's about to be abducted by aliens. A man sees a drunk college student stumbling down the middle of Main Street, disrupting traffic. A restaurant owner is concerned a panhandler may be scaring away customers. A mother fears her son may attempt suicide in the coming hours. They all call 911. When the cops arrive, officers handle the situations however they do. Maybe they write a citation or make an arrest. Maybe they perform a welfare check. In worst-case scenarios, they might use unnecessary physical force while confronting the panhandler or cart the son off to the psych ward without confirming that he's really suicidal. Though police officers are dispatched, their skills aren't particularly useful here. What the callers really need is a mental health professional, a peer support specialist, a list of resources, and a promised follow-up in a few days. And when somebody gets shot across town, the handful of on-the-clock officers are tied up with situations where their guns and handcuffs aren't needed. This is the type of scenario that the city of Durham hopes to prevent with its new community safety pilot programs, three of which launched last week. The programs, which operate under the name HEART, Holistic Empathetic Assistance Response Teams, aim to better connect those experiencing mental or behavioral health crises with the proper care, starting from the moment a person calls 911. The pilots were implemented by the Durham Community Safety Department, which works to provide community-based approaches to public safety as alternatives to traditional policing. Though the department celebrated its first birthday only last week, HEART is years in the making. 2 years ago, around the time of the national George Floyd protests, a cohort of city and state employees, led by then Durham City Manager Tom Bonfield, teamed up with the Research Triangle Institute, RTI, to lay a foundation of research for the pilots. When the department was formed in 2021, its fledgling staff hit the ground running, creating a multi-agency planning team, compiling data from cities piloting similar programs, and conducting resident interviews and focus groups. As a result, Durham is now the first city in North Carolina to dispatch mental health professionals in response to 9/11 calls. The first pilot, Crisis Call Diversion, makes several changes to the system that Durham's Emergency Communications Center uses. Emergency dispatchers will ask callers the same script of questions they usually do, but now the software may recommend a new type of first responder, mental health professional, instead of police, firefighters, or EMS services. The program embeds a mental health clinician in the 911 center, allowing callers who are at risk of self-harm or undergoing mental health crises to be transferred to an expert. To assess which calls warrant the mental health response, the Community Safety Department utilized data from an RTI-led analysis of 9/11 calls. After examining 3 years' worth of Durham 9/11 data, the analysis concluded that 15% of Durham's 9/11 calls could be addressed by mental health professionals instead of police officers. Anise Vance, assistant director at the Community Safety Department, says, "There's a misconception about 9/11 calls. Folks think 9/11 is either there's a cardiac arrest or there's some violent incident occurring. The truth is most 9/11 calls have nothing to do with any kind of violent or threatening incidents. Many calls are just people who are scared or worried or confused and are calling to ask for a little help because they don't know where else to turn. Calls currently eligible for a community safety response include suicide threats, trespassing, welfare checks, panhandling and intoxication, among others. In some cases, callers may trigger the second pilot program. That's a three-person team of skilled first responders, a mental health clinician, peer support specialist, and an emergency medical technician who can now be dispatched in response to nonviolent mental health crises or quality of life concerns. HART responders, who have already successfully cleared several trespass and welfare checks, are uniformed in friendly teal T-shirts branded with the team logo, a heart sandwiched by two chat bubbles signifying care and communication. They're also unarmed. Community Safety Department Director Ryan Smith says, "We don't arm firefighters. We don't arm paramedics. As a rule of thumb, we only want to send weapons into scenes where we feel it's absolutely necessary. As a precaution, the team's location will be tracked by emergency dispatch services, and responders can quickly radio a request for police backup. The HART team is operating primarily within a limited region for now, covering about 15 square miles selected due to the high volume of crisis calls. The service area is shaped like a heeled boot, with the toe touching Old West Durham, the heel hovering over NC Central University, and the leg reaching up to Hebron Road. 48 hours after a HART team's initial encounter, the third pilot program, Care Navigation, comes into play, sending a two-person team of a licensed clinician and a peer support specialist to follow up with the person in need and ensure they've been connected with the proper resources or care." According to Vance, the emerging literature on alternative crisis response work strongly indicates that the follow-up moment is crucial for long-term progress. Vance says, "We want to be in a position where we're not always just responding, but we're proactively out in communities changing the trajectories of some of our neighbors." Slated to launch later this year, the fourth and final program will dispatch pairs of mental health clinicians and police officers in response to behavioral health-related 9/11 calls that may pose greater safety risks. The three functioning pilots currently operate from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on weekdays, with plans to expand hours into the evenings and weekends sometime in the next few months. 1 year from now, the efficacy of all four programs will be measured using surveys, call outcome data, formal third-party evaluations, and in-depth interviews with both first responders and crisis response recipients. Durham Beyond Policing, an activist group working to defund prisons and police departments and reinvest resources into black and brown communities, is pleased about the launch of the HART programs and commended local advocates for the years they've spent protesting, writing letters, and signing petitions in support of that cause. In a Facebook post, though, the group shared concerns that the pilots are so underfunded they may be set up for failure. The Durham City Council last month signed off on a budget that adds only 7 new employees to the Community Safety Department, requiring the 4 HART programs to be operated by a staff of 20, 5 administrative personnel, and 15 field workers. Manju Rajendran, a community organizer for Durham Beyond Policing, who also serves on Durham's Community Safety Task Force, says the city should have approved twice as much funding for the pilot rollout. There's plenty of demand for HART services, but spread too thin, the 2 teams of responders may burn out. Minimal staffing may also prevent the programs from being adequately evaluated next year, she says. Quote, when will the Community Safety Department have time to be able to respond to the current demand for calls, much less conduct the kind of rigorous data collection and qualitative research that they need to be doing along the way for us to really understand the value of these pilots? I don't understand why they didn't provide the staffing that would set up these programs for success. She points to Albuquerque, New Mexico, a city comparable in size to Durham, whose similar crisis intervention pilot, launched last year, has proven successful with 36 first responders, 12 administrators, although even the Albuquerque team has found itself shorthanded at times. In its Facebook post, Durham Beyond Policing condemned the city council for its January vote against reallocating 15 vacancies in the Durham Police Department to the Community Safety Department. At the time, those vacancies were frozen in the police department's budget. The post reads, their pro-cop ideological stance disallowed them from allocating staffing that would have cost them nothing additional. Those vacancies continue to sit vacant in the DPD department budget. The advocacy group has similarly, criticized the council's decision to fund the forthcoming Shot Spotter pilot program, which will see gunshot detection sensors installed in some areas of Durham later this year. Shot Spotter, which aims to help first responders save shooting victims and make arrests by detecting the precise location a shot was fired, has been a divisive issue among both the council and the community at large, with many dubbing the technology overpriced, ineffective, and conducive to over-policing. While ShotSpotter and HART pilots each seek to enhance public safety, there are some stark contrasts between the two. ShotSpotter was approved without an in-depth community engagement process, its critics say, and threatens to advance mass incarceration in black and brown neighborhoods and squander first responders' time with false positive alerts. It also shows little favorable data from its implementation in other cities and has no concrete evaluation plan. The HART pilots, on the other hand, were born out of local organizing, stand to prevent communities of color from over-policing, and free up the availability of first responders. Mirror programs that have seen widespread success in other cities and pose clear and thorough evaluation metrics. On its website, the Shot Spotter maintains that it has a 0.5% false positive rates, though numerous third-party investigations in cities including Chicago and San Diego have found that percentage to be much higher. A MacArthur Justice Center investigation found that ShotSpotter false alarms dispatch Chicago police on as many as 60 trips a day. Meanwhile, according to the Community Safety Department cited RTI analysis of 9/11 calls, skilled, unarmed HART teams could address an average of 1,580 calls a month and save law enforcement around 970 monthly hours if the program had the funding, Rajendran notes. Though she's disappointed that the HART pilots didn't receive more funding, she says she's thrilled to witness the rollout nonetheless. Quote, I have been in a number of different situations where I've needed to reach out for help for myself or for loved ones over the years in moments of crisis and needed for better options to be available in terms of accessing appropriate care. I've just been feeling goosebumps of joy all week. I'll now move in a brief article from IndieWeek.com, the online version, which some of which articles are not made into the print issue. And this one is saying, unserved warrant in the Emmett Till murder case found. In late June, a team searching the Mississippi courthouse basement for evidence surrounding the lynching of Emmett Till found an unserved warrant. The warrant, certified as authentic by a LaFleur County clerk on June 21st, charged a white woman in the 1955 kidnapping of the black teenager. Nearly 70 years later, Till's relatives and advocates want justice. The white woman in question, Carolyn Bryant Donham, listed as Mrs. Roy Bryant on the warrant, is now about 87 years old and living in Raleigh. At the time of the slaying, Donham was married to one of the two white men who were tried and acquitted in the weeks after 14-year-old Till was abducted from a bed in a relative's home, murdered, and dumped in a river. Though Bryant Donham's husband, Roy Bryant, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, were both acquitted by the all-white jury, they later confessed to the murder and were named alongside Carolyn Bryant Donham in the kidnapping warrant. Both have since died. The team that found the unserved warrant included members of the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation and two of Till's relatives, cousin Deborah Watts and her daughter Terry Watts. Relatives want to use the warrant to arrest Donham. Keith Beauchamp, who created the documentary film The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till, says there's enough new evidence to prosecute her. Till was accused of whistling at Donham while at the local market owned by the Donhams. Just a few days later, his body was found mutilated in the Tallahatchie River. Till's death laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement after his mother chose to hold him an open casket funeral, which ignited nationwide shock, anger, and a deeper understanding of life for black communities in the South. In Duke University historian Tim Tyson's 2017 book, The Blood of Emmett Till, Tyson recounted a 2008 interview he did with Donham, one of the only ones she has done since the murder, in which she allegedly recanted her original witness stand claims that Till had grabbed her and made suggestive remarks, stating, quote, "You tell these stories for so long they seem true, but that part is not true." Last Friday afternoon, civil rights activists gathered in Raleigh at the district attorney's office calling for Donham's arrest. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman told the News and Observer this weekend she is waiting to hear from the LaFleur County's District Attorney's Office, which is the Mississippi jurisdiction for the case, before taking any action. If the district attorney there plans to move forward, Freeman says she plans to work with Mississippi to bring Donham to justice after almost 70 years of delay. Another column from IndieWeek.com by Mariana Fabian. The town of Cary has issued a request for proposals, RFP, for three new food and beverage concepts for the second phase of the development of what's currently being called the Downtown Cary Park. The town of Cary is huge, soon to be open. Downtown Park has been 19 years in the making. Now the town's putting the finishing touches on the park plans, including seeking out the vendors who will bring the park's food and drink spaces to life. This request for proposals for three new food and beverage concepts, the development of what's currently being called Downtown Cary Park. The town and other stakeholders have invested $69 million into this core of downtown attraction. And the park is set to open to Cary residents in the spring of 2023. According to town officials, The park will total 7 acres in size and will be located across Academy, Park, Walker, and Walnut Streets. The park will provide lots of green space, including a great lawn fronted by a pavilion. Around that lawn, a series of unique spaces or rooms will link to one another via paved walking trails. Other features include performance places, market spaces, public art woven into the park and landscape, food and beverage facilities, a play area for kids, interactive water features, a dog playing field, and walkways for strolling and relaxing. The RFP proposes 3 new food and beverage concepts for visitors to choose from: the Bark Bar, the Marketplace, and the Support Kitchen. The Bark Bar will be a coffee shop with juice and pastries in the morning, then serve beer and wine as the day transitions, and will be located near dog play areas for pets and owners to hang out. The Marketplace will serve as a general store with food and drink options, with more variety on its menu. It'll serve pastries, picnic foods, and wines and champagnes. The Support Kitchen will be located underneath Academy Street Plaza, a new urban meeting plaza, which is also a part of Phase 2 development of the park. The kitchen will be much smaller and will provide easy grab-and-go items, along with picnic essentials for park visitors. The town of Cary is seeking vendors to submit proposals to cultivate and lease these 3 new spaces through August. Individuals or entities interested in leasing the spots in downtown Cary should schedule a 20-minute appointment time for a phone call or a virtual Q&A by emailing Joy Ennis. As I searched through that report, Joy Ennis is only listed by name, and there is no actual email address, and I'll take some research. And Maddie Ray provides this column called New Evolution. In the 20 years since Archie Smith III took over as Durham County Clerk of the Superior Court, he has seen much change. The Durham metro area population skyrocketed, growing by about 129,000. 3 different mayors have sat on city council. High-rise apartments have overtaken Brightleaf and Warehouse districts. The court system even migrated down the block to a new building. Smith said, "Durham, the town you see is not the town I grew up in. Every evolution of Durham is exciting to me. Except the newest evolution of Durham's court system does not include him." In May of 2022, Smith lost re-election to newcomer Amina Thompson, and in December he will return to civilian life. Change has finally caught up with the man who was the center of the courts for 20 years, and he says he's okay with that. "Time flies," he said quietly. Later he added, "Shake your fist at the storm and you're going to get wet." Smith, a Durham native and NC Central University School of Law graduate, described the clerk's office as the hub of the court system. Smith rattled off all the different duties taken on by him and his staff of 72. In addition to keeping records for courthouse proceedings, which the Internet appears to think is a clerk's only job, the role includes judging probate, appointing guardians for minors, overseeing incompetency cases, and settling general disputes. Phew. Smith, whose chatty, jovial presence puts strangers at ease, thrives under the pressure. He describes his job as a professional problem solver. When a case comes across his desk, it leaves resolved. He says, "Probably one of the best things about being the clerk, I'm challenged every day." Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry emphasized Smith's dedication to conquering daunting tasks. The two collaborated in the Durham Expunction and Restoration Program, a reform effort that expunges records that prevent Durham residents from regaining their driver's licenses. Together, they worked to waive older traffic violations for over 35,000 Durham residents and 1,200 petitions for expungement. DeBerry said of Smith, "That required tremendous lift from the clerk, and he certainly could have said no to that, but he was enthusiastic about being involved in making that happen. Smith's legacy does not stop there. LGBTQ groups have long endorsed him due to his support for the development of landmark second parent adoption procedures in Durham starting around 2004. This historic process allowed same-sex couples to have both parents recognized on birth certificates and other legal documents before same-sex marriage was legalized in 2015. Smith had the choice to turn away documents requesting a second name, but he fought for them, said attorney Sherry Patrick. It was not a popular choice, but he did it because he believes that all families are important, she said, that all families count. Smith has brought all types of families together across Durham County and created one right in the courthouse, too. It's not your usual workplace atmosphere, he said. We're conscious of that. The office is shockingly close-knit for its size. Smith points to photos of hundreds of his employees over the years, recounting fond memories, such as when employee Pam Apple bought his granddaughter her first Easter basket. Smith encourages all of his clerks and assistants to bring their children into the office if necessary, for instance, if childcare falls through or if there's a teacher workday. And as he says, they'll all become aunts and uncles for the day. The Starship Archive, as Smith has nicknamed his office, is stocked with chocolates and toys for the children to play with, as his granddaughters, now 16 and 10, once did. Those granddaughters were well known around the office when they were children. As he showed me around the courtroom, Smith picked up the gavel sound block, riddled with dents and scratches. I've never used one of those in court in 20 years, he laughed. My eldest granddaughter, she would put on my old robe, she would sit in this chair with myself, a couple of lawyers, and she would hold court and bang on this. In just 6 months, Smith will leave the bench when Thompson steps into the role. Thompson, the first African-American clerk elected in Durham history, is a fresh face on the scene. Smith had not seen an opponent for the county clerk position since 2002, but Thompson barreled into office with 65% of the vote in May. Her agenda of reform and modernization won the endorsement of the People's Alliance. That's a key political organization that had long supported Smith. To Smith, this shift of support was a major reason for his loss. It was simply politics, he said, throwing up his hands. DeBerry, despite being fond of Smith, says Thompson may be the better choice to bring Durham's courts into the future as North Carolina moves towards e-courts. That's a system for keeping court records in the cloud rather than physical copies, and becomes more technologically sophisticated. DeBerry says, I think that it just takes a different mindset. I don't know that Smith would have led the charge. So, what's next for Smith? He gushed about spending more time with his wife of 24 years and granddaughters, which he has put off over his years as a clerk. He also hopes to do more with organizations like the Durham Sports Club and his Masonic Lodge and get started on long-neglected repair projects. He said with a laugh, I'll clear the decks. I've got a whole laundry list of projects and things I haven't been able to have the time for. As Smith has watched Durham transform, he relies on things he calls anchors, little pieces of the city that never seem to change. The Lucky Strike smokestack, the Sower statue on Duke's East Campus, the historic Durham Athletic Park. There where you get your anchor to the community and to yourself. And after two decades as the hub of Durham's criminal justice system for many, Smith has become an anchor himself. DeBerry said, he's from a different time in Durham when it was much more of a small town. A guy like him, who grew up on the wrong side of the track, so to speak, could grow up to go to law school and have a real impact on his community. She added, those kinds of guys don't come along anymore. And unfortunately, I have only a minute or two to give a small detail of Ta-Nehisi McDonald's article called Colorful Visions about the Charlotte artist Romar Bearden. When harassment from a white mob forced the family of artist Romar Bearden to flee their Charlotte home for Harlem in 1915, he was only 4 years old. In a new biography, Romar Bearden, In the Homeland of His Imagination, An Artist's Reckoning with the South, Yale University scholar Glenda Gilmore chronicles four generations of Bearden's remarkable family and points to how one of the most prolific, original, and acclaimed American artists of the 20th century offered episodic glimpses of his Charlotte childhood. The beautifully illustrated new volume, published by the University of North Carolina Press, offers a rich and compelling portrait of Bearden's family and how it informed his journey of becoming a nationally recognized artist. Gilmore writes, as he created paintings and collages, he often did not know what was real, what was partially real, and what was a dream. This creative conundrum drove his artistic expression and sparked his imagination. The author adds, a century and a half of historical neglect, family secrets, silences, and a racist archive that hides the black past stole a factual family story from Bearden, even as he often tried to capture it visually. Born in Charlotte, he moved to Harlem with his family when he was a toddler and later Pittsburgh. He died in New York City on March 12, 1988. He was a formerly trained artist and full-time social worker whose artistic trajectory reflects the history of 20th century art, social realism during the 1930s, abstract expressionism in the 40s, and the iconic collage paintings that began in the late 1950s, Gilmore writes. Though he spent most of his childhood up north, Bearden's legacy began to flourish in Charlotte in the early 2000s. When the Charlotte Mint Museum exhibited six of his collages. Landmarks and community spots from the city showed up often in his work. In 2011, a five-acre park was built in his name near where his great-grandparents' home once stood. Near the end of his life, Gilmore notes, Bearden said, I never left Charlotte except physically. As a distinguished historian notes, the great artist also said this, you leave and then return to the homeland of your imagination. It's a powerful volume, writes Ta-Nehisi McDonald. And we must close this week's issue of Indie Week after our initial Friday broadcast. You can find it in the podcast portion of ncreadingservice.org. And I'm John Federson saying so long. Once again from Indie Week.